This Migration Policy Institute discussion is entitled, Does Low-Skilled Immigration Hurt the U.S. Economy? Assessing the Evidence. The event discusses an MPI report written by Georgetown Public Policy Institute Professor Harry Holzer. Today's discussion is opened by MPI Senior Vice President Michael Fix. Here's Michael.
Let me just say before we begin a couple of words about the paper's origins. A year or so ago, we approached Harry and asked him to review the current economic literature and to give us his read on what it meant for immigration policy. We asked him to look at this literature less through the lens of the ivory tower economist that he certainly is, but rather through the lens of the former chief economist of the Department of Labor that he once was. And that, and in that position, we assumed and presumed that decisions had to be made about immigration policy on quite imperfect information. He's delivered big time with an excellent paper on what's known, what's not known, and what we should do in order to maximize immigrants' contributions, and you have that paper before you. Let me briefly note the other distinguished members of the panel who will discuss the paper and carry on the conversation this morning. And in the order in which they are going to speak, let me introduce Dimitri Papadimitriou, another former senior Labor Department official and the founder and the president of the Migration Policy Institute. Then Daryl West, who's vice president and director of governance studies and director of technology innovation at the Brookings Institution, will talk to us. He has himself just written a terrific new paper called Creating Brain Gain for U.S. Employers, the Role of Immigration Policy. And then finally, we'll hear from Doris Meisner, now trapped in traffic, who will wrap up. Doris is a senior fellow here at MPI, where she directs MPI's work on U.S. immigration policy and was the former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Finally, let me just note that Harry's paper was commissioned as part of the Migration Policy Institute's Labor Market Working Group, which has brought together some of the best analysts in economics and migration in order to update our understandings of immigration's economic effects over the last 18 months. Other papers in the Labor Markets Working Group series have been written by the economist Giovanni Perry, by Gordon Hansen, by Pia Arrhenius, and they're available outside and on MPI's website, www.migrationpolicy.org. So with that, we'll drive through the presentations and then open up for questions. And when we get to questions, you should remember that this session is being videocast. So before you add your question, please identify yourself and your affiliation before you ask your question. So with that, let me turn the podium over to Harry, and we'll get started.
Thank you, Michael, and good morning. And thank you to the Migration Policy Institute for inviting me and sponsoring me and writing this paper and in organizing this event today. I'm really happy to be here and be doing this. Given the shortness of the hour, I think I'm going to dive right in. So the focus of this effort is less educated immigrants, by which we mean those with no more than a high school diploma and usually not even a high school diploma. And the focus is really going to be on the economics. Very simply, is it in the economic interest of the United States to have this magnitude of less educated immigrants coming into the country? There are other obviously important questions to ask about this. There are social issues and moral issues and humanitarian issues. Those matter too. As an economist, one thing I happen to know a little bit about is the economics of labor markets. And B, I just want to focus on those bottom line issues, because I think those are important, although not the only things that matter. And when you look at this literature, I'm really struck by how different the literature is regarding more educated immigrants, by which we usually mean those with college degrees or more, versus those who are less educated. I mean, among knowledgeable analysts, among people who do this work, there seems to be much less controversy about the benefits provided by highly educated immigrants in the United States, the contributions they make to innovation and to competitiveness in our economy. I think as much as you can have consensus on an issue, I think there's some consensus on that, although maybe consensus overstates, but it seems to me that's the dominant view. When you come to the less educated, there's much less consensus. There's big questions about what are the benefits to the U.S. economy, what are the costs, how those might change under a different policy regime, and then what all of this might mean for reform. So, in fact, if you start with the goals, let's start by assuming, as is almost always true in economic policy, that any mechanism we look at creates some benefits to the economy and some costs. Economists automatically say, well, let's think about how we can maximize the benefits and try to minimize the costs. I'm going to argue that the costs are mostly competition for jobs with native-born workers and some fiscal costs. We'll talk about the benefits in a few minutes. But, of course, it's always much easier to do that in theory. And economists always assume you can look at the benefits and costs and come up with some very specific optimal amount of immigration, and of course, in reality, it's always much more difficult to figure out what that amount would be. There are conflicts, right? The things we might do to increase the benefits at the same time increase the costs. You know, anything we do to let in more immigrants to reduce costs to employer or prices to consumers at the same time would increase competition. So there's conflicts between those goals and important distributional questions. The allegation has been made that a lot of the benefits of less skilled immigration actually go to higher income Americans, while the costs are borne by lower income and less educated native born Americans. So we're going to want to analyze the distribution of those costs and benefits as well as their overall magnitudes. And there's an additional goal as well, and I'm going to come back to this issue a few times. In the beginning, when immigrants are in their source countries, we here in the United States consider them as outsiders, and we can decide whether we want them here or not, whether it's in our interest to have them here. Of course, once they arrive legally and choose to stay and become citizens, they are some of us. And we have to think differently about, because they are now American citizens, we have to think about what benefits them, whereas we don't necessarily have to think that at the very outset when you ask the question, is it in our national interest? But that's a funny tendency that we have to think about over time, that immigration actually changes who constitutes the American people and the American economy and what we think about their interests. So keep that in mind. I'll come back to that point. So to try to get at those goals, I'll just simply lay out three questions. What are the costs and benefits of the current flow of unskilled immigrants, and to whom do they accrue? In other words, do they accrue more to higher income Americans or lower income Americans or those in the middle? Secondly, to what extent would those costs and benefits change with the shift in legal status of immigrants and in the categories? You know, we have different legal categories through which immigrants can legally enter and or illegally enter. And if we juggle those around, how would that change the cost of benefits? And then third, if we believe once immigrants are here legally and become citizens that we have some obligation or some interest in upgrading their status and in integrating them, what is the interest of native-born workers in the U.S. economy and having that happen as well? So I'll try to talk a little about each of those things and then turn to the policy implications. Well, let me start with this issue of what are the costs of immigration. And by far, what the American public worries the most about, and what I think the economics profession is worried the most about, is to what extent do immigrants compete with native-born workers for jobs? And to what extent does that competition either result in lower employment for native-born, less educated Americans, or lower earnings? Now, for those of us who are immersed in this area, we know that there are two very well-known labor economists who work in this area, Professor David Card at Berkeley, Professor George Borjas at Harvard. And at least on the surface, they use very different statistical methodologies in trying to answer this question of do immigrants hurt native-born workers and compete with them. David Card has come up with the answer that there's virtually no negative impact, almost negligible negative impacts of immigrants on Americans, including less educated Americans, and George Borjas and a few of his colleagues at Harvard have estimated more substantial negative effects. So there seems to be a real conflict between those two views. I think there's actually less conflict than meets the eye. If you look carefully at the numbers, and I make the argument in the paper that I think in some sense David Card understates a little bit the negative effects, the possible competition, but I think for other reasons, Borjas probably overstates it. So I believe the answer is probably somewhere in between. And in fact, if you read Borjas carefully, he acknowledges, for instance, that in the long run, when you let capital flow into areas
where immigrants tend to concentrate, that that's going to mitigate the costs. And over the long run, even Borja says his costs are too high. Look at his long-run estimates. They're not that different from David Card. So I'm going to look at this literature and say, my reading of it is that there probably is some cost, but it's relatively modest in magnitude compared to the overall loss of earnings that less educated Americans have experienced in recent years. And I say, well, why are the impacts so modest? It's almost counterintuitive because, you know, there's a large flow of immigrants coming into the country. It is expanding the supply of high school dropouts in the U.S. labor market by something like 30 to 40%. And that's a big supply shift. In economics, that usually means a pretty big negative impact on wages. I think there's three reasons why the impact is so modest. Number one, immigrants are consumers as well as producers. So they contribute to demand for goods and services as well as to the supply. So that's going to offset somewhat their effect on supply. Secondly, they are imperfect substitutes for these native-born workers with whom they compete. Because of the lack of language facility, maybe because of some other skill issues, immigrants don't compete with all less educated Americans. They're targeted in certain sectors. And in fact, they compete much more with other immigrants who are concentrated in those same sectors. And this is universally accepted by economists, that there might be a modest effect of immigrants on the native-born. They have a much more, when there's a large flow of immigrants coming in, they really do more damage to the immigrants who are already here in those same sectors competing for those same jobs. And then the third issue is the production techniques of employers. Employers adjust their production techniques. So in the presence of a lot of less skilled immigrants, they're going to use more labor-intensive techniques. And in the absence of those immigrants, they're going to use more capital-intensive techniques because the labor then becomes more expensive, which means in the absence of the immigrants, wouldn't necessarily see all these jobs that they now hold available. You'd see some of them, but presumably not all of them. So that leads us to the question, well, suppose we could somehow curtail that flow of immigrants. What would the new labor market equilibria look like? And it's a little hard to figure that out because there's uncertainties over exactly how employers would adjust, exactly how native-born workers would adjust. There's issues of labor demand responses, labor supply responses that would vary, I think, across local areas, across industries. I think we know one thing. If all of a sudden we really ramped up enforcement efforts very dramatically and we deported all existing immigrants here and immediately shut off the pipeline, I think that would be a very disruptive effort. It would disrupt those firms and those industries that rely heavily on these immigrants right now, and it would be disruptive to the native-born workers who are employed in those firms and industries and to the consumers who rely on them as well. So I think there'd be costs to very quickly turning off the spigot, but there's a different question if we did that somewhat more gradually, how the economy would adjust. This is my overall view, and then, of course, there's the whole different question of fiscal effects. Do immigrants impose a fiscal burden on governments? Other folks have looked at this more closely. I think it depends really on the answers are different for local governments, especially local governments in areas with a lot of immigrants that bear more burden versus the federal government. And certainly there's a difference between the short-run effects and the long run. Over the long run, across generations, as immigrants integrate and their incomes grow, I think the burden drops and the contributions immigrants make grows over time. So that's my reading of the different costs, both labor market and fiscal. Benefits to the economy. First of all, obviously, low-wage immigrants are beneficial to employers, and it increases what economists call employer surplus, which is just profits, really, by another name. But it also provides benefits to consumers. And it's important to put a number, or to try to put a number. And the best effort to do this has been done by an economist at the University of Chicago named Patricia Cortez in a paper of the Journal of Political Economy. It was her doctoral dissertation at MIT. She comes up with some interesting numbers. She argues that the benefits are much higher for high-income consumers rather than for low-income consumers. And she makes this argument that other economists like Borjas have made, that it's the less educated Americans that bear the cost, but higher income, more educated Americans, they have the benefits when the immigrants become our nannies and our landscape and cook in the restaurants that we like to go to. I think Cortez's paper is a very good paper, but I think it probably understates the benefits to lower income Americans for data reasons. She did the best she could do with the data she had. My reading, and again, I detail this in the paper, is that because of data issues, she understates the benefits of immigration in lowering costs in construction and housing, in food, and in healthcare and elder care, three important areas that are that eat up big parts of low-income people's budgets. So my reading of it is that there are substantial benefits to lower income as well as higher income Americans on the consumer side. And then there's other effects. Cortez has another paper showing that, again, this large supply of nannies and other works makes it easier for high-income moms to enter the workforce. And that's a positive for the U.S. economy, I think. It's certainly a positive for those families. And there's other arguments about how even low-skilled immigration contributes to economic efficiency, the efficiency of adjustments, and to dynamism in other ways. So I view there are some substantial benefits to all Americans as well as costs. So what's the punchline of this? You know, we can't come up with a single number for what's the exact optimal amount of immigration. Can we make a case that the U.S. would be better off with a large increase in the flow of these immigrants? I would say no, you can't really make that case. Can you make a case we'd be better off with fewer of them? I don't think you can make that case either. You're kind of left with the sense, yeah, there's some costs, which to me seem quite modest. There are some benefits. I don't see a case for dramatic movement in either direction away from the current equilibrium, just in terms of numbers. Some people say, well, what happens when the baby boomers retire? And I think baby boomer retirements are going to occur later and much more gradually than we might have thought even a few years ago, partially because of what's happened to our 401ks and a bunch of other reasons. So I think the baby boomer retirements is going to be much less of a dramatic impact on the labor market. When it occurs, all else equal, it will tend to tighten up labor markets a little bit, and that probably means that whatever costs the immigrants impose will be reduced and the benefits would probably rise. But again, I expect that effect to be gradual. It doesn't change the overall story. And then you get this other conflict that's been pointed out to me by some folks at MPI. You know, we often make the argument that when we talk about native-born Americans, we'd like to see education levels rise, right? We'd like to see, we'd all be better off as a country if we had fewer high school dropouts, more people with post-secondary education. I believe that. Well, does that mean, therefore, that you let in this big flow of unskilled immigrants who then at some point become less educated Americans? Is that a conflict? Because once they become citizens, we worry a lot more about, and I acknowledge that conflict by saying not doesn't necessarily change the punchline of the paper, because there are avenues to help those immigrants and their children and grandchildren later integrate that we want to take seriously. I think I'm running a little bit behind in time, so I should probably speed things up here. Just different categories of immigration, legal versus illegal. They likely impose different benefits and costs. Illegal immigrants are paid less than legal immigrants. That means they may contribute even more on the consumer side to lower costs and prices, but they do more to compete and undercut the wages of native-born. It's not a level playing field. And I think there are other costs as well. These people are more likely to be in poverty. Their children are more likely to grow up in poverty. And I've done other work that suggests that poverty is not such a great thing for the American economy. So I think on net, illegal immigrants as illegals contribute more negatively and less positively. It would be better if we could convert them into legal immigrants, and that would change the ratio of benefits and costs. I also think there's arguments for employment-based immigration. Right now, very little of the unskilled immigrants, you know, outside of H-2A and H-2C and those categories, very little of their flows are employment-based. And I think there's some benefits because then you can adjust the magnitudes of the flows in response to economic conditions. So to me, it sort of says, a sensible way to think about this is to take that current flow and create incentives to shift that from an illegal flow to a legal flow, raise the costs of illegal immigration to the workers themselves and the employers who use them, but also raise the benefits of possible legal means. And I'll come back to what it would take to do that. Now, integration, you know, this is an important issue. And as I sort of said, you know, we have this big question of once the immigrants are here and they become Americans, we might think differently about their status and whether it's in our interest to maintain them. And especially when you think of their children and grandchildren coming up. So I think there is an interest in helping them to integrate and spending some resources. A couple of potential problems. Number one, any public resources that you might spend on immigrant integration are already so stretched and already so limited that you might well have competition for public resources between native-born folks and the immigrants themselves. And secondly, if right now most of the competition is at the low end, well, if you integrate the immigrants and help them move up, are you then spreading the competition from the low end more to the middle end? Possibly you are, certainly in the short run. Think of an industry like construction, where right now the jobs are very constrained. But my argument is I think that over time and over the long run, my belief is that there will be enough demand in those middle-skill sectors to absorb an increase in
the fraction of immigrants who end up in middle-skill jobs, even if they start off strictly as low-skill immigrants. So I think you can still make an argument for integration, but let's be honest that it might generate some competition for scarce resources and scarce jobs in the short run. Well, what does all this mean for policy? You know, you can see where I'm drifting on this. To me, it leads us in a direction of some version of comprehensive immigration reform. I know that's more or less dead in the real near future in the United States, but I think overall it kind of makes sense. You know, it doesn't make sense to kick out all the illegals right now from an economic point of view. It makes sense to create benefits and costs that would encourage them to become a legal flow rather than an illegal flow. And that's my view. Some of that means strengthening enforcement, but it also means, so one way of doing that, of changing that flow, would be to have a guest worker program that's employment-based, but where there are real options for these folks to become permanent citizens afterwards, possibly some kind of provisional visa that might lead to permanent citizenship afterwards. There are a few other additional things I argue for here. I think to the extent we use guest workers and employers pay fees, those fees ought to be higher than they often are right now. You know, if you're going to have prices, those prices might as well clear the market. Right now, those prices are way too low to clear the market. If you raise those fees, you'd have more resources, which then could be spent on ameliorating some of the costs of immigration. You know, you might create more training programs for native-born workers, especially for the less educated native-born workers. I also think you could have macroeconomic adjustments to the numbers of folks you let in based on the state of the economy. And I would try to allow for some sort of state-level variation and flexibility, although I recognize this is mostly a federal policy, and it's hard to think of exactly where that state-level variation would come from. When I say this, I want to acknowledge many uncertainties remain about how all this would play out. The effectiveness of this different enforcement strategies. You know, what I've seen so far on E-Verify isn't so great. I think there's other enforcement mechanisms that do the job, but at some cost. We don't really know. If you tried to create incentives for the current illegals to become legal, we don't really know how well that would work. What level of incentives, both positive and negative, would it take to really transform those flows? How would the natives respond? If you did cut the flow of illegals, at what point would native-born workers start to move into those jobs? How would employers respond? There's many, many questions that remain uncertain. I want to acknowledge those and say we should still move ahead. Move ahead, but as always, evaluate carefully, try to learn from anything we do on the enforcement side and on the policy side, and then maybe use that information to adjust policy as we go. Two big questions, and then I'll stop, that remain on the table. You know, I've said that whatever you think about the unskilled, there are large benefits to having more skilled immigrants in the U.S. economy. I think that's really clear-cut. So this question of what ought to be the proper mix of skilled and unskilled, and should we so heavily continue to rely on family-based immigration? And here again, the social arguments and the moral arguments may lead us in one direction. The economic arguments may lead us in a different direction. I leave that as a large open question for others to wrestle with. And I want to, you know, raise again the end of this thing. This is, you know, the last couple of decades in the United States have been a pretty bad time for native-born, less educated workers, especially less educated men. They've been hurt a lot, and illegal immigrants tend to be scapegoated, I believe, for a lot of, because I think illegal immigrants, by all of the estimates that I see, account for a very, very small part of the pain that's been inflicted on these folks. Let's get serious about that, and let's think a lot harder about what it would take to improve the economic prospects of all less educated workers in the United States, especially the native-born. Thank you, and I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Now joining us is Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Migration Policy Institute.
Good morning, everyone, and it's good to see you. Happy New Year. I think that rarely does an author address not only the letter, but also the spirit of an assignment, if we can call this an assignment, Harry. And we are grateful for you having done so. We asked Harry to, in a sense, adjudicate the literature, and he has done so. These are issues that bedevil anyone who really tries to come to terms with the status quo in the American way of doing immigration. And I think that Harry has really thought hard and deeply about sort of the main arguments that are being made in the literature. And when you read the paper, you will actually see that he's not just splitting the difference. He's not one of those economists that say on the one hand, on the other hand. He's not someone who shies away from hard conclusions. And for those of us, okay. For those of us who have toiled in the immigration grounds, if you will, for a long time, it is a breath of fresh air. Some people are going to be disappointed. I was deeply disappointed that they didn't say you need 169,262.5 law skilled workers. And that's the number. But those people who will actually be even more disappointed, and I'm only joking about that, of course, are the people who really like all or nothing answers. We should do away with law-skilled immigrants, or we should have more of them. That's not what this paper is about. This is a thoughtful, somber analysis, an evaluation of the literature, and an honest attempt to say what is possible for us to make judgments on the basis of the literature and what it's not. I will ask you a couple of questions because, needless to say, you know, in trying to cover a very difficult topic in 20 minutes, you've had to skip over parts of the paper. I actually would like to go to the paper. And we all know, to a certain degree, more or less, that there is fundamentally a big debate out there. And sometimes it gets crystallized around single names, Borges versus Card. Card, since the early 1980s, has been following sort of one path, a path that just, as Harry said, tends to lowball the effects of immigration on natives. And Borges, who for some of his career, not all of his career, because there were changes in the argumentation that George used until about the early to mid-90s, and again, some changes perhaps in the last couple of years again, but he tends to be at the upper bound of what the effects are. And what I'd like for you to do for us, if you don't mind, is to really get below the headlines on this. Why methodologically? Because I think this is, you know, a group that is, you know, full of people who live immigration or who are deeply interested in immigration. So perhaps you can discuss the long and short run effects. Why does the methodological issues, what is the difference, you know, between the one sort of school of thought, as it were, and the other one? And also discuss a somewhat troubling finding that you agree with, that the effects on black men tend to be higher, including the complexities of why they tend to be higher. And I think that would be a great service to the audience. And I also would like you to speculate a little bit, since, you know, a lot of the work that the Institute does is comparative international work, as to whether this is a set of findings that may be uniquely Anglo-American. And, you know, you have a couple of statements on the paper that point in that direction. And by Anglo-American, I really mean the UK and the United States rather than the English-speaking countries. Countries, you know, that have less, perhaps, organized labor markets and where people actually move, et cetera, et cetera. But that's important, I think, for, you know, the audience to hear more about. And I'd like to emphasize that we are now in a period of time in the United States where things are in a state of flux. And Harry doesn't shy away from the fact that some of the assumptions and evaluations that he makes may be subject to rethinking if certain of the conditions that we have experienced in the last couple of years continue over the next several years. You know, for instance, in order for the United States to get out of the hole in terms of jobs and get to a point where we have unemployment between 5 and 6%, we would have to create a very large number of jobs every year. And let me give you a sense of what the projections are. If we created the average number of jobs that we created in the 1990s, puts us a bit over 300,000 jobs, net jobs, per year, it will take us until about 2016 to actually find ourselves at a reasonable unemployment level. But if we create the average number of jobs that we created in the 2000s, in the first decade of this century, it will take us until 2022 in order to find ourselves back to where we were. In other words, an awful lot of how these things will play out and the issues about low wage, you know, labor and the issues about immigration size, et cetera, will actually be tested day by day in the real world. And again, Harry doesn't shy away from it. He mentioned the issues that this current economy has been bringing to the fore, which is questions about retirement, baby boomers who may have lost their nest egg, who may work longer because they need to or because they're healthier than previous cohorts. That is going to shape, influence how many workers the economy will need, new workers the economy will need, and how many low-wage workers the economy will need. These are difficult questions that involve demographics, that involve and choices made by employers and choices made by individuals, which will change dramatically what it is that we're likely to see in the U.S. labor market and the U.S. economy in the years and decades ahead. I also loved that you had a reasonable person actually discuss with sensitivity and truth about who benefits from all of this low-wage labor. All too often, some people, you know the persuasion, argue that it is somehow employers. They reap these remarkable benefits by exploiting people. They pocket the difference, if you will, going back to your Marx. And they're doing well while the society and everybody else is doing poorly. Some others add a bit more complexity to this and says, you know, people at the higher end, people like perhaps many of us here, benefit from all of this low-wage labor because, indeed, products and services are becoming cheaper. But Harry had the audacity to actually argue that everybody does, including those people at the low end of the income scale. And that has always been true. Whether we like it or not, the fact that food, housing, and many services that everyone uses are lower, are cost less as a result of all of this immigration that we have in the United States, really becomes a benefit to everyone. You could argue that it sustains a low-wage economy, that there is a vicious circle. I'm not going to, you know, say that perhaps it doesn't do that, but nonetheless, it's important that we recognize that we are all implicated in the status quo. And I think if we don't recognize that, we can make progress in terms of policy. I will end because I'm sure that, you know, people think that I'm going, some of my colleagues, too long. I think fundamentally, we are at a point where we cannot answer the big question. Is the kind of immigration, particularly at the low end, that we have been getting over the past decades, the last couple of decades or perhaps a bit longer, is it good for the economy, and how good is it for the economy? The more difficult question, however, is it good for the American society? And you cannot answer these questions. Certainly, Harry has given us sort of the tools with which to actually make our own judgments on this, and I think we deeply appreciate it.
The next speaker is Daryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here. It's nice to see so much interest in this topic, basically a standing room only crowd. Michael and Demetrius, you know, anytime you have to move to a bigger room, that's always good in the event business. At Brookings, we always view that as a good baseline. But I think it really shows how much interest there is in the topic of immigration, especially the low-end part of that equation. And it's a very important topic that we all need to think very seriously about. I appreciate the chance to offer my views on Harry's paper. And, you know, there's so much emotion surrounding the issue of immigration. I mean, the thing that really jumped out at me when I looked at Harry's paper was just its emphasis on facts. You know, in all the things we do at Brookings and the research that I have done, I've always made the argument of all of the policy topics in American politics, you know, it just seems like there's so much controversy surrounding immigration, but there are so many myths in that area. And so anyone who attempts to introduce more facts into the discussion, I'm all in favor of that. He focuses on what do we know, what don't we know. He has some provocative conclusions. Some of you may agree or disagree with particular things he said, but it is a very thoughtful paper, and I hope you take a close look at it. I think he is right on the benefits at the high-skilled end of it. There are lots of virtues of that. I had a book published by Brookings last year entitled Brain Gain, where I look at that part of the equation and found half of the Silicon Valley companies have immigrant founders or co-founders, that those people make valuable contributions for economic development. You know, people often forget that Google had a Russian founder, Intel had a Hungarian founder, eBay had a founder coming from France, and Yahoo had someone coming from Taiwan. What would the American economy look like today if Google were in Russia, Intel were in Hungary, eBay were in France, and Yahoo was in Taiwan? Now, as Harry points out in his paper, the low-end part of that equation is more complicated, certainly when you look at the research that has been conducted. There is a blend of costs and benefits there. What he argues on the cost side is that there is some negative impact on high school dropouts, but it is not a very large impact. We are undertaking some research at Brookings on missed economic opportunities. And it seems to me there may be some different effects if you separate the wage side from the employment side. Because certainly when you talk to businesses in particular industries, they still complain about not being able to find workers in hotels, restaurants, and agriculture in particular. They say Americans won't do many of those jobs even in a time of high unemployment and that they have difficulty filling their positions. So we have a project underway in which we will analyze whether that actually is the case. What is the evidence for that proposition, and what is the economic rationale for immigration? Harry also looks at the research on benefits, and I've always thought this was the neglected question in immigration, you know, regardless of whether you're looking at the high or the low skill end, that everybody always likes to focus on the cost of immigration, but they never really look at the benefits that these people bring. So you end up with an asymmetric tenor to that overall discussion. And he points out, rightfully, I believe, in his paper, that low-skill workers consume goods and services, they pay taxes, they increase demand for labor in certain industries, and that when you're looking at the overall question of are these people good or not so good for our economy, you really have to incorporate both the costs as well as the benefits. And it seems to me they do make contributions to the economy independent of their costs through their purchases, renting homes, and all the other activities that they have underway. He makes an interesting argument in his paper, which I want to highlight because I think it's very important. He does note that illegal immigrants may decrease wages more because sometimes, or maybe oftentimes, they get paid less for the jobs that they do. But then he makes an interesting twist on that argument when he says that if we actually do provide a pathway to citizenship, that may actually help with the wage pressures because it will be more difficult for employers to lowball wages in that situation. I think that's a very important point because it basically suggests that there are policy remedies that could address some of these economic arguments. At the end of his paper, he focuses on some of the policy conclusions that he draws from his analysis of the literature. And I just want to run through and hit three or four points there. One point, which I absolutely agree with, is the need to focus on the economic impact of immigration and not just the security and law enforcement aspects. From my analysis of the immigration area, I think we could spend an unlimited amount of money on border security and law enforcement. There still are going to be illegal immigrants. I have heard estimates as high as 40% that when you look at the 12 million people here in the United States illegally, 40% of those individuals did not cross the border illegally. Like when we think of illegal immigrants, we always focus on, you know, the Mexican coming across the border illegally. People have suggested that in reality, 40% of the illegal immigrants actually came here legally, you know, through a student visa, work visa, or whatever, and then they overstayed the visa. And so you can spend as much money as you want on border security. It is not going to address that 40% of the puzzle. So I think that's an important thing to think about when we're kind of thinking about policy discussions, resource allocations, and kind of the current emphasis today on border security, which it's important to emphasize that, but it should not be the only thing that we look at. Harry also notes the importance of improving the design of our overall immigration system. I think that's an important point, that it should be easier for employees to switch across jobs more easily. That would reduce whatever exploitation that there may be in the current system. He suggests that we link admission levels to macroeconomic conditions and adjust the numbers each year based on economic circumstances. In my book, A Brain Gain, one of the things I did was to look at 50 years of public opinion data on immigration. And you can really see when you look over a long period of time, kind of the ebbs and flows of how the American public thinks about immigration. And it very much mirrors the economic cycle that during periods of high unemployment, you can see the public grows more concerned, more worried about job competition. They kind of turn inwards. But when times are better, they become a little more liberal in their views, a little more tolerant of immigration, a little less worried about the wage pressures. So I have always thought that some linking mechanism in terms of the admission level based on the macroeconomic condition would be good from a political standpoint, in the sense that it actually incorporates the natural ups and downs of public opinion on immigration, and so there may be both an economic and political rationale for that type of linkage. I think, you know, when I look at the 200-year history of how the United States has dealt with immigration, we have made a lot of bad mistakes, and elected officials and members of Congress have often been some of the worst offenders. And so I really believe the more we can start to insulate immigration from the political process, either through indexing mechanisms or commissions or other types of devices, that will be good for the immigration area in the long run. Harry noted the need to improve the mix of immigration so that more high-skilled workers could come in. That's an argument in my Brain Gain book that I also endorse. Although I don't want to make it sound like that's the only thing we should focus on. I mean, right now, only about 6% of our visas are going for the high-skilled end. It's a relatively small portion of the overall argument. So in my book, I suggest we can raise that a little bit. You know, even if you're only raising it by 100,000, the economic contributions could be quite valuable. You're still saving a lot of numbers for low-skilled workers as well as family-based visas. So I think there can be minor adjustments that could improve that mix without necessarily changing the general framework that we hit. The last point that I will make is this argument about immigrant integration. I really think that's an important part of this puzzle. We really need to improve the resources for integration because that is one way in which we can actually increase the benefits while reducing the costs of immigration, because the faster that immigrants integrate, the less likely they are to become a drain on government resources, and then that will be valuable for the system as a whole. Thank you very much.
Up next is Doris Meisner, MPI's Senior Fellow and Director of MPI's U.S. Immigration Policy Program.
Good morning, and good morning, Harry. I'm going to begin also by complimenting you on this piece, really more from the standpoint of a layperson, lay reader, because this is a very accessible paper, and it takes what is often very, very dense material, and it puts it into one place where you can get the overview, get the picture, and that is very useful. My job this morning is to take up the policy points specifically that are made in the paper. And I'm most pleased to do that because two of the policy points are points that for which I have great affection, as do colleagues of mine at MPI, and it is because we surfaced these ideas several years ago in work that we did here with a task force on immigration and America's future. So I'm very glad to see them appear because we've been polishing them ever since and trying to keep them alive. And you've added some nuance to them. Now, these are the ideas of provisional visas and of a standing commission to deal with adjusting the levels of immigration on a more regular basis. So on provisional visas, this, of course, is the idea of a new visa category, which would allow for people to come to the country temporarily or for short periods of time, but recognizes that most of the work for which that kind of a visa would exist is ongoing in the labor market, and that there ought to be a way under certain criteria and circumstances for people with that kind of entry into the country to ultimately adjust to permanent residence. We, of course, have argued that point based on the reality on the ground of the behavior of workers, jobs, the nature of the economy, and so on. But what Harry has added to it, I think, is really very important, and it's another good nuance on the issue, and that is that this kind of a visa with the opportunity under certain circumstances to adjust status could actually serve as an incentive to playing by the rules, as an incentive to come through legal avenues rather than illegal avenues. And that is an extremely important insight, I think. We need as many incentives as possible, obviously, in the system in order to try to regularize and have above board flows. And that's a very nice way, a very realistic additional attribute. So that's a good contribution. On the standing commission idea, we've, of course, argued that idea, the idea of adjusting levels on a regular basis based on the evidence of what's happening in the both the macro and more micro economies. And we've, carried that banner from the standpoint of flexibility, overcoming the rigidity of a system that is not responsive, and obviously on the basis of recognizing that we're in an increasingly dynamic economy and there's no way you can foresee everything. The last several years is the best possible example of that, what it is that's happened since the recession and during the recession. But what Harry adds to this, I think, that is extremely useful and important, is that he's given us this very nice paper. He's gone through the evidence. He's done, as Dimitri has described, a really good job of calling it as it is. But ultimately, the bigger takeaway, it seems to me, from the paper is that regardless of what we know and regardless of what it tells us, mostly we don't know. I mean, that's a key theme in this paper, is that there is so much that we don't know and don't understand. And so the importance of having mechanisms that recognize that even what we think we know may not last very long and may not actually be as fully realized as what we think we know. That's an important insight based on looking at the literature. And it adds to the reasons that we simply have to have, as you said, a linking mechanism, a way to have a much more living way of adjusting our levels of employment-based immigration. And, of course, what gives that real punch is that Harry has been a decision maker. He knows what it's like to be asked as an economist by policymakers, what is your best advice? What should we do? And he points out, as many people who have been decision makers know, you don't always have all the information. In fact, you generally don't have all the information that you need in order to make key judgments, but you must make the judgments. And so you do it based on the best that you have, but that has to be able to be adjusted as you go because you learn from the impacts of those decisions. And if there is not a way to make the adjustments, then you're really in a very disadvantaged position. So thanks for reinforcing those points. We think those are important policy directions. It's nice to have fuller argumentation for them. But there are a couple of other points, policy points that are made in this paper that I think are very interesting and that intrigue me. And I want to make a couple comments on three of them. One has to do with state-level variations. Another has to do with an employer fee and a fee for offsetting fiscal costs. And then Harry also talks a bit about family immigration. So on the issue of state variations, I think it's a really interesting time to put that issue on the table. What Harry is saying is that their states should possibly be more fully engaged or brought into the discussion of levels of employment-based immigration. That's not the first time that idea has come up. I think in one of the draft bills, either the 2006 or 2007, I don't remember which, but in some of that discussion, there was at some point, I think, a 10% unemployment level provision that was written in that any state or labor market sector or however defined that was at 10% more unemployment would by definition not be eligible for certain categories of, I think it was temporary worker program. But this is what Harry is suggesting is a positive way of looking at it, is pulling states in from the standpoint of what their needs might be, recognizing that there are different levels of economic productivity, employment, unemployment around the country, and that should be incorporated into the system in some way. I think it really would be very interesting to investigate those kinds of ideas more fully, particularly with the time that we're in now where a lot of the action is moving to the state level because of the void at the federal level. But that action is moving to the state level, and what we hear about it, at least, is all very much on the punitive side. What we're talking about here is something that is on the positive side of a more positive conversation between the federal government and the state governments, seems to me, on how employment-based immigration might serve their needs. And that engagement would be a very interesting thing to look at and develop. This is done in Canada, as many of you know, on a regular basis. It's part of their formal system of how they set their levels, but it would be an interesting topic to look at further in our system. On employers and employer fees, the idea of employer fees for less skilled workers has also been around for a while, but it's typically a fee that is kind of a fine for the privilege of having these access to these sorts of workers, certainly for the purposes of processing, you know, doing the paper processing to bring people into the country. Here you're talking about a fee for the purposes of offsetting fiscal costs, but that's all you say. So the question is, what kinds of fiscal costs? How would something like that work? And I think that's a very interesting topic. I mean, my own candidate would be, let's look at healthcare issues, where employment-based, particularly less skilled immigrants are concerned, as most importantly because of the new healthcare law and what that now means in terms of Americans being insured, unauthorized immigrants being the only designate a group, I think, that is ineligible to participate in the system. But in a system that we're going into under the new healthcare policy, this question of healthcare costs vis-a-vis employment-based immigrants, particularly less skilled, I think is a really interesting juxtaposition and is a very important area to think about further. Finally, family immigration. You've played a little bit with family immigration, and of course, when we talk about family immigration, it's always the synonym or the proxy for less skilled immigration. But that's the question that I'd like to put on the table also as an intriguing question, because we really don't understand as much about family immigration, family-based immigration, and employment and the labor market as we should and as we need to. It is, as Harry pointed out, the dominant element of our legal-based immigration. We do it for reasons that don't have to do with employment in the labor market, but of course, family-based immigrants are very important actors in labor markets. And it does seem to me that the way that this paper is structured and the issues that are raised in the paper just begs for more understanding of what is happening with family-based immigrants. I suspect that the issues of upward mobility, the issues of medium skill positions, some of the work that we've done in other research that we've released in the last year or two that has to do with bridge positions, I suspect that there is a real relationship there with family-based immigrants and with some of the normative positive aspects of family immigration. So that's an intriguing area that you point to that would be very interesting to do more work on. So it seems to me those are all very important, rich territory of policy issues. And as with any good research, as with any good analysis, what it really does is stimulate more questions and stimulate an appetite for more information and research. And if that's the test, then you get very high marks, Harry. Thank you.
So I want to thank my colleagues for very, very meaty comments, and I also want to thank them even more heartily for staying exactly on time in their comments. And so I'd like to open the floor up. We have about 25 minutes for questions from the floor, and then we will, before we close, we're going to turn Dimitri's questions back to Harry and let him try to cope with a couple of those, since I thought they were very helpful. Why don't we start right here in the front?
Thank you. Peggy Orchowski, excuse me, I'm the congressional correspondent for the Hispanic Outlook on Higher Education, and wrote a book on immigration called Immigration and the American Dream. I think the question that's never considered when we talk about legalizing workers who work on the lower scale, well, there's two I would like to hear more about, and one on the impact on black workers. You've alluded to it a couple of times, and I know Mr. Holtz has worked on that, so I'd like to hear about that. And number two, what happens to those low-skilled jobs that supposedly Americans and legal workers won't do once you've legalized the workforce? Do we need a constant stream of illegal workers to do them, since apparently it's said that legal workers won't do them? So what happens to those jobs? Or is there incentive to make them more capital rather than labor intensive?
So those are both very important questions. And let me deal with the second question first. And Daryl raised it as well. You know, this common statement, well, you know, we need to have these immigrants because Americans simply won't take those jobs. And that's actually a very simplistic way of thinking about it. Because the issue is, right now, at these wage levels and under these circumstances, Americans really don't want to take those jobs. But in the absence of these immigrants, wage levels would start to rise. And at some point, presumably, they might get positive enough that it would induce more Americans to take those jobs. And so you know, if your concern is really about the well-being of these American workers, you might say, I'm willing to take that risk and see if we can push those wages up enough. The problem with that argument is that you know, it varies across sectors a lot how willing I think Americans would start to be to take those jobs. For instance, in residential construction, I would guess that they would be relatively more willing to take them. If you think about farm workers, I'd say they're much less willing. And of course,
The question is, at some point, it would take such large increases. So it's what economists call, what's the elasticity of labor supply and what it is on the labor demand side. At what point, what wage increases would it take in these different sectors before American workers would start considering them acceptable, and acceptable enough to offset the negatives in status and other things of taking those jobs? But at some point, if those wages rise to that level, employers would respond by saying, these costs are just too high on us. We're going to mechanize these jobs. And I think that's actually the bigger response that I see in the literature. It's not that all these higher wage jobs all of a sudden become available to Americans. It's that employers simply use more capital intensive mechanisms to pick the fruit and to do some of those other tasks. I think simply saying Americans won't do them is wrong. But then simply assuming those jobs would be available, I think that's wrong, too. And I talk about in the paper about the uncertainty about exactly what those equilibria would look like under a very different regime. The other question you raise is about, and Dimitri raised it, too, are blacks and especially black men uniquely hurt by this supply of immigrants? And I guess my answer there is, well, maybe, but I'm just not sure. You could, again, make the argument that in some sectors, if you could, and again, I go to construction, that's a sector where there's a large concentration of immigrants in residential construction. Those are relatively well-paying jobs compared to what the options a lot of these less skilled men have. And in the absence of those immigrants, they might be very willing to take those jobs. The question is, would employers be that willing to hire them under those circumstances? Or, there's a lot of reasons why less educated black men have limited access to jobs, and a lot of things involving spatial issues and informal networks and discrimination and fears that employers have of this population. It's not obvious that in the absence of immigrants, employers would turn around and embrace, although it's likely they would embrace them to a somewhat greater extent. So is the impact larger? Yeah, there's a decent chance that they bear a somewhat greater a disproportionate brunt of the cost of immigration. Again, it's hard for me to say how large it is. And again, I'm reluctant to say that it is a dominant factor in the difficulties these men have in the labor market.
Brian Roberts. So I wanted to ask you, it's been asserted in the talk or maybe the comments that we don't really have a comprehensive analysis of the impact of low-skilled immigration flows on U.S. economic welfare, and I wanted to ask you and the panel: there are studies actually that use computable general equilibrium modeling to evaluate impacts at the U.S. national level and by sector of changes in low-skilled illegal immigration flows. And I think that one of these studies reveals something very interesting, which is you mention it in your paper. You talk about immigrant upgrading in your paper, but the CGE paper that I'm very familiar with illustrates how native-born upgrading in response to low-skilled immigration inflows leads to a significant positive welfare impact, economic welfare impact. And interestingly enough, if you go back to the literature and the commission reports of 100 years ago, you see analysts of the impact of immigration on the U.S. economy back then directly talking about this this phenomenon and how it's improving U.S. economic welfare. So it seems to be happening in that first immigration wave and also apparently in the second one.
I do talk about that in the paper. I didn't have time to. It was when I was going through the benefits, I had this. My fourth bullet point was for sort of other effects on economic efficiency and dynamism, and really that was one of the things I said, and I don't know the CGE paper you're talking about. I do know some other work by Giovanni Perry and others who have made that argument using more traditional estimation methods that when immigrants come into these categories, they raise the incentives for native-born folks to work a little harder and upgrade their skills and upgrade the kind of jobs. I find that a reasonably persuasive paper, and so I would agree with you that that's yet one more mechanism. I don't know that we've nailed the magnitude of that, just like on so many of these other topics, but I agree with you. It's yet one more positive effect that we should acknowledge and talk about.
In the back, so I'm not discriminating. On the left.
Thank you. Sonia Michelle from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Going back to the first question and your response to it, Dr. Holzer, aren't there certain fields where no matter that you just can't mechanize, like elder care and child care and certain jobs in the hospitality industry? And if we're depending on low-wage workers to perform those jobs, doesn't that raise a question of social justice? I mean, shouldn't we be paying these workers more if they're doing work that's so valuable and that we can't export? We can't really export our elders and our children to be taken care of in some other country.
So if I understand your question correctly, you're not arguing that we should limit the supply of immigrants and let market forces drive those wages. I think I'm interpreting you sort of saying we should let the supply of immigrants stay here, let the market wages remain low, and then use legal and like minimum wages or those kinds of government mandates to raise. Am I correctly interpreting you're not arguing. I don't think you're arguing that we need to curtail the immigrant flow and let the market forces drive them up. You want to accept the immigrants in those jobs and simply find other means to pay them higher. Is that correct? So two arguments. Yes, I'm sympathetic to that point of view, and I worry about how little. There's two reasons that you worry about the low wages of so many workers in these sectors. Number one is simply the moral argument, the social justice argument. And number two, it's not even so great for the quality of healthcare because it leads to so much turnover. So I certainly agree with your goal. The question is, you know, again, your argument is the opponents of immigration would agree with you partially and say, yeah, let's cut off those immigrants and that will drive up wages. The question is are there effective means of doing so given the ample supply of immigrants willing to take those jobs on a low wage basis and also given the cost constraints on the system? You know, I think we recently passed healthcare reform. I think we did a much better job of expanding access to healthcare than we did on limiting costs. And to me, the most frightening economic fact that we face going forward that we haven't even begun to address in this country is what to do with spiraling healthcare costs. We haven't even gotten to first base on that issue, and it really does threaten the economic future. So I agree with you that at some level we'd like to see those wages rise, and they'd have to be offset by productivity increases to not increase. You know, I just wonder then more about what would the mechanisms be under current market circumstances and how effective would they be, and, you know, how would that whole system adjust? That would be my concern.
My name is Joe Freeman, and I also am with the Woodrow Wilson Center. I would like to ask about the geographic distribution of cost and benefits. It strikes me, without having any data, that the costs are borne primarily by certain states, and other states, such as this region of the country, are heavily beneficiaries of at least illegal immigration, and that there are some serious policy implications for that differential distribution of cost and benefits.
My quick answer is that I agree with you. About that, and then I'm not sure. I mean, so as Doris pointed out, one of the things I say in the paper is that if we increased fees, it would be appropriate to use those fees to ameliorate some of the costs that some of those states disproportionately bear. And I'm certainly open to many to other mechanisms, other ideas that people might have to redistribute that burden a little bit. I think those data exist. I think folks have looked. I didn't concentrate that much on that, but I think there are estimates of those costs in the literature.
And this particular problem is not limited just to immigration. I mean, for example, we deal with exactly the same issue on military base closings. You know, the geographic impact of that cost is unequally distributed across the country, and so basically the federal government has community impact payments to areas that are disproportionately affected by that particular policy decision.
My question is, up to now you've been talking about costs and benefits, but not responsibility. And I think that without putting in the responsibilities factor, you're going to miss a lot. In other words, the immigration after 1970 was almost, it was so obvious, and yet there were not policies in place by the government to control the flow in. And businesses were highly irresponsible hiring these people without papers. So now who bears the brunt, the cost? It's those immigrants that came in to survive. Another part here is that you're not looking at the future. The some very famous studies have been made by the, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little nervous, but the, well, let me start with David Harvey, who has maintained that businesses have over $2 trillion. They're sitting on it. They're not lending it. They're not using it. And they really are looking forward to a place where they can plunk their money, but they need 3% interest in order to do so. Now, this does not look possible in the future. What the future looks like is pretty dismal. Essentially, we have 117 million over the age of 65. They're moving into the big cities, and that's where the poor are. So the whites, the older whites, are also moving into the big cities. In 10 years, we're going to have a major clash. So I think you people who are writing here and are establishing policy, you have an obligation to look at the full picture, not just its cost benefits.
You raise a wider range of issues. I didn't fully understand the implications of all your comments, to be honest, but I'd be happy to talk more and understand what you're worried about. My charge as an economist was to look at the economic costs and benefits. I think we need to have clear answers, or as clear as possible, on those limited questions. And you're right, they're not the only questions, and they're not the only set of issues. And just because I focus on them doesn't mean that there aren't other important issues out there as well.
One important fact I forgot is that the population growth among whites is down to zero. 200,000 births over deaths. Over 80% of the growth was in minorities in the past decade. And in the future, it's going to be even greater.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Charlie Erickson with Hispanic Link News Service here in Washington. A couple of questions. One, any of you have a comment as to what the impact has been over the amnesty that was signed by President Reagan? Two, I realize most everybody's talking about economics here. Any of you have any comment as to the cultural benefits or general impact, and specifically the impact that has been felt in a lot of small towns where over the past 20 years, immigrant population has gone up as high as 25% of the folks living in those cities, and we've seen impacts from Allentown to Shenandoah that have been dramatically different because of the cities have been able to address those.
I mean, I know on the second question that you raised, the cultural benefits to small towns, my colleague Audrey Singer has done a lot of work on the demography of immigration, and she's always made the point that immigration has changed so dramatically because it used to be immigrants went to a few major cities. Now immigrants are really they've gone to the suburbs, they've gone to smaller towns, and so immigrants are more present in different types of communities than ever has been the case. And in terms of the cultural impact of that, it really cuts both ways. You know, for people who are upset about immigrants, they now confront immigrants in their hometown in ways that they didn't before. But then it also, I think, has helped to diversify cultures in a lot of different places, in small towns and suburbs and so on, in all sorts of different ways, just through all the benefits that immigrants bring, different foods, different cultures, different ways of thinking, cultural enrichment, and so on.
If I might say something to that, too. Becoming is the verb that one has to use when talking about countries that grow through immigration, rather than being. And what you're pointing to is that, again, after perhaps a bit of a pause for about 40 or so years, the United States has been changing, and changing at a dramatic pace due to immigration. And we're not the only country that does that. Countries that have always defined themselves with the verb of being rather than becoming, where change is not in their vocabulary, are changing at even faster rates than we are. And the challenge here for policymakers, of course, is to make sure that you manage this constant change, you manage the transitions. This way you can
take advantage of what is positive and try to minimize what is negative. And this paper, what Harry did and what the conversation has been about, is about trying to sort of estimate what the costs and benefits are and try to find a way of increasing the benefits and decreasing the costs. I know that this is, you know, sort of a $1 trillion question because now we're only talking trillions. But nonetheless, you know, that's the challenge that faces us and pretty much, you know, every other advanced industrial society. And, of course, cities. You know, the reference about Audrey's research and the research of this institute about the fact that, you know, there have been all these places that really hadn't seen much immigration since the 1930s and have this extraordinary increase in immigration since 1990. And you can measure it in multiples of doubling and tripling and quadrupling and 11 times as many immigrants in 2011, I guess, when the latest results of the results of the latest census come out, will show once more how immigration is spreading throughout the country. And again, the responsibility of policymakers is to try to make sure that they manage this change effectively.
Okay, my name is Cecilia Morales. I'm with the Employment and Training Reporter. I would wonder if you would address some of the cyclical how immigration and cyclical variations in the economy, particularly the issues that have come up. I've seen it in Michael Fix's book, and I've seen it in some of the other Giovanni Perry's work, that the question of whether immigrants are susceptible to the forces that drive people in and out of the labor market like everybody else or not. And in the recession that was closest to this one, like in the 80s, we didn't have a pure laboratory condition because the Reagan administration had the Operation Jobs that expelled many immigrants under the scapegoating ways, and Doris Meissner was involved in that. And today we have not had that kind of thing, and I'm just wondering in this recession if there is any evidence that there's been a response, diminution of employment, or people have just left, or whatnot.
Well, in fact, Michael could answer. I mean, the best papers have been commissioned here at MPI on this, and I think they show that there has been large effects, and this recession even more than most, because it's so the impact on residential construction has been so large, and that's a sector where so many immigrants are concentrated, that even more than usual in this recession, but in most recessions, they are in the categories of workers that are quite sensitive to the downturn. And another margin on which you see that affecting is the inflows. The inflows of new immigrants have been way down. There is some adjustment. So fewer people are coming in if they know the sectors in which they're traditionally employed are taking an economic beating. So in some sense, the market already reflects some of those adjustment mechanisms. And then presumably if you had an employment-based system where some people are here on employment-based, that you'd have yet another mechanism for using those flows as yet another adjustment.
I'll just give you a teaser for a paper that we're working on right now where we looked at the Hispanic population, 16 to 26, who arrived after they were 16 years old in the United States, which is a very good proxy for this population that comes and goes, essentially the unauthorized worker-related population. And before the recession and after the recession, the size of that population fell absolutely dramatically. Plus, if you look at the population that was 16 to 26, and you take it back to the year 2000, and you look at how many are in the country today, if you age them forward, you know, 10 years, they fell by almost half. So where you would expect that population to grow, they've left, which isn't true of a lot of other subpopulations that we've looked at. So the effects, to me, are quite striking. Yes, Dimitri?
I'm sorry. The question is too broad, what the effects of 1986 were, but I'll give you three effects. They're not the only effects, but three major effects. Three major effects. The first one is that the rate of immigration accelerated, but more importantly, the rate of immigration of those people who benefited from the 1986 amnesty, as you call it, accelerated most. So if you look at the distribution of immigrants who got most of this, became legal, most of these slots, their rate of growth, Latinos and Mexicans, continued to go in a very steep upward slope in the 1990s and since then. The second effect is that we witnessed some upward mobility among those people who got legal status. Not as much as some advocates claim, not as little as some other advocates claim. And the third one is illegal immigration continued unabated. But it continued unabated because of two things that either the 1986 law did not do, or it did, but we did not implement it. The first is that the 86 law ignored the fact that immigration demand for immigrants would continue. So it did nothing about adjusting the legal immigration formula. It's something that we must do if we want to relieve some of the pressure for illegal immigration. The second one is the issue of controls. The 1986 law instituted controls, both at the labor market and at the border, but it did not implement them. So these were three sets of effects, not the only ones again, but three major ones.
Well, we are absolutely faithful about closing on time, and it's 10:30. And so what I'd like to do is ask all the panelists just to make any concluding 1 or 2 minute comments they may choose to make, and if none, we'll close the panel. Harry?
I'm just going to say thank you. Thank you to all three of my discussants who I think made very thoughtful comments that I appreciate. Thanks to all of you for your comments and suggestions. And I want to say one other thing. So much of what I wrote in this paper relies very heavily on work done here at MPI, which is always very high in quality. I've learned an enormous amount. I didn't know a lot of this stuff when I started working on this, and I learned an enormous amount. The work is very high quality. Darren, I was saying before, you hear a lot of nonsense in this city on this issue by advocates on both sides of the aisle, and if you want good, thoughtful analysis, MPI is a place where you often find it. So thank you to all of you for that as well.
So thanks, Harry, for those comments, and thank you all for coming, and we'll be down here for questions and comments.
For more information on MPI research, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/LMI.